Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, inequality, the politics of the budget fight, and the politics of the Federal Reserve, we'll explore the relationship. Then, scholars analyze comics, and comics analyze scholars. Both analyze the role of comedy in politics. We are joined by Henry Brady. Henry Brady is the Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of The Unheavenly Chorus, Unequal Political Voice in the Broken Promise of American Democracy, and co-editor of Capturing Campaign Effects. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Henry Brady. It's great to have you back here.
It's good to be here.
You've been studying political participation and political inequality and essentially have found that this inequality is really troubling for American democracy in general. I wonder now, if you look at the debates that are going on in Congress with whether or not we defund the Affordable Health Care Act, shut down the government, and the related debates, how is this connected to the work you've done with participation in inequality?
Well, I mean, you see it most clearly probably in the Food Stamps Act and the agriculture bill, where you have a tremendous defunding of food stamps. And right now, that's going to mean that a lot of people who basically depend upon food stamps to get their supper are not going to be able to get them. And if you look at political participation in America, you find out that, of course, it's the poor who participate less, it's the rich who participate more, and most strikingly that it's the rich. I mean, this is sort of an obvious finding, and we all know it, but it's really worth emphasizing it. It's the rich who give enormous amounts of money to politics, and as a result, the concerns of the rich often take precedence over the concerns of the poor. There's also an intergenerational aspect to this, which is young people participate a lot less than older people, and so we get an emphasis upon things that are of concern to older people, like entitlements, Social Security and Medicare, and not things that are important to younger people, like higher education and often poverty programs, since a lot of young people are in poverty with single mothers.
The other big piece, of course, is that President Obama's signature program was trying to expand health care in some meaningful way. Do you see that as tied into this as well?
Well, yeah, that's certainly another program, although Obamacare is so complicated at this point with what's been going on that it's harder to make the exact connections. But certainly it is the case that an analysis of the benefits would suggest that this is obviously extending health care to a lot of lower-income people, and as a result, it's going to help those people have health care they never had before. So there's certainly that income dimension. On the other hand, there is the fact that it's going to turn out that younger people will probably pay more for health care and, in fact, be required to have health care, although that's both good because it means they will have health care insurance, but it's bad for those who in the past could get by without paying for health care insurance and just depend upon luck to get through their younger years without having some kind of tragic health crisis cause them to essentially be impoverished by what happened to them.
And it seems to me that if, in fact, the Congress doesn't come to an agreement and they do shut the government down, the people that are most affected are, again, the poor and the young.
It's certainly going to be the case that a lot of government programs that serve those constituencies are going to be affected, at least in the first instance. There's just also the fact that, of course, the sequester, which is this meat cleaver approach to solving our budgetary problems, which was designed actually as sort of a poison pill, with the idea that nobody would ultimately go along with the craziness of what the sequester was doing to both the domestic budget and the defense budget. Nevertheless, that's what's become the law of the land. And so we're cutting into programs which are investments in America's future. So, for example, we're cutting back on research and development spending. We're cutting back on a lot of discretionary programs that actually are investments that help make the future a better place. And so we've got budgetary policy, which is just crazy in terms of long-term consequences.
You would think that even the very wealthy who may think for a moment that it's against their short-term interests would recognize the kind of national interest of maintaining these kinds of programs.
I think they do. Certainly, I think if you talk to some of the folks on Wall Street and some of the responsible business leaders, they get that. But of course, the Republican Party right now is very much in the throes of a big fight between Tea Party advocates who tend to be from small towns, small business owners, who by and large find government to be more oppressive than helpful to them, There may be a little bit of truth to that from their perspective. And those folks have got a tremendous voice in the Republican Party, and they're basically calling the shots with respect to what's going on.
And then we've also got the Federal Reserve issue going on, Ben Bernanke stepping down. Obama's now going to make the new appointment for the Fed chair, Federal Reserve. Can you help us understand how the Federal Reserve impacts everyday economics for us?
Right. That's one of those things where it's a little complicated, but basically the fact of the matter is by controlling the money supply, the Federal Reserve can stimulate or not stimulate the economy, can cause inflation or not cause inflation. And so the money supply turns out to be a very important way in which you can make sure there is economic growth. And I think a very strong argument can be made that through what Ben Bernanke's done over the last 5 years, he first averted essentially a big, great American depression. We certainly had a great recession, but we didn't have a great depression, and Ben Bernanke's actions probably had a lot to do with that. And probably he also avoided a world depression by making sure that he stimulated the economy by pumping money into the economy, that makes interest rates lower, that makes people invest, that makes people hire people and jobs occur, and therefore you get stimulation of the economy. So the Federal Reserve is a very important way in which we create jobs. Now, the danger is if we pump too much money in, you can almost think of this as a reservoir, you're pumping in too much money, you start getting inflation and prices start to rise. And a lot of people have been worried that, in fact, all the money that's pumped in will have the longer-term or even medium-term effect of causing drastic inflation. But the truth is, we just haven't seen that. There's no real evidence of inflation increasing to any great degree. And so the argument has been, and the Fed certainly continues to make this argument, that as long as they don't see inflation, they're going to keep stimulating the economy because the economy is still not back to where it should be.
And how much does the new chair, or the old chair for that matter, their own ideology, how much does that matter in this process?
Well, it probably matters a fair amount. The Fed is a complicated organization because the Fed itself has a board of governors, which is a 7 members. And then there's a bunch of regional banks. There's 12 regional banks, the New York Fed, and the San Francisco Fed, the Kansas City Fed, and so forth. And then composed of those two groups is the Open Market Committee, which actually makes decisions about interest rates and about stimulating the economy. That committee is the 7 governors plus 5 of those 12 banks that rotate on and off. And so that's the committee where a lot of the power resides in terms of making decisions about how much you're going to stimulate or not stimulate the economy. But because it involves all the personalities, the 7 governors plus the 5 regional bank heads, you got to have somebody as a leader who can sort of lay out a direction and then work with all those disparate personalities. So the different regional feds tend to have different personalities, actually. The Kansas City Fed is much different than the New York City Fed or the San Francisco Fed. And it has to be able to work with those leaders and get them to go along with some consistent policy. And Ben Bernanke's done that very well.
And the person who is seen as the shoe-in is Janet Yellen. What do we expect from her?
Well, Janet, of course, was head of the San Francisco Fed. She is an economist from the University of California at Berkeley, technically quite competent and very knowledgeable, so she's got all the knowledge. Having run the San Francisco Fed, she knows what a regional Fed head does. And now she's vice chair of the Federal Reserve in Washington. So she's sort of had all the different positions you'd want somebody to have. Great technical expertise, regional Fed head, and now somebody who's been on the Board of Governors and the vice chair working with Ben Bernanke to make things happen. She's got excellent people skills. Some people are worried that she may be not forceful enough. I personally don't think that's going to be the case. I think she's just one of those people who does it very softly. She speaks softly, but she gets things done. And so I think she's going to be an excellent choice to bring people together and make sure that there's a consistent, sensible policy that's followed.
She's expected to be approved pretty easily, as I'm hearing.
Right now, the Democrats seem to be, well, I mean, of course, they are the people who said, look, they wouldn't approve. A bunch of Democrats said they would not approve Larry Summers, who was apparently the president's first choice. And Larry was a guy with tremendous experience as well, having been head of the Treasury Department in Bill Clinton years and also worked with Obama through the Economic Council in the White House during the tough and difficult years of the recession, and also being technically a really brilliant economist. But Larry also had some baggage.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Henry Brady.
Thank you.
Henry Brady is the dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and professor of political science and public policy at University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of The Unheavenly Chorus, Unequal Political Voice in the Broken Promise of American Democracy, and co-editor of Capturing Campaign Effects. When we come back, how comedy and humor impact everything from our health to our societies. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Humor affects many things: our health, our disposition, our relationships, and our organizations. Can it also help to change politics and society? With us are three experts. Amber Day is a professor of performance studies in the English and Cultural Studies Department at Bryant University. She's the author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate, and Breaking Boundaries in Politics and Political Entertainment Studies. John Morrill is professor of philosophy and department chair of religious studies at William & Mary College. He is the founder of International Society for Humor Studies and the author of Comic Relief, A Comprehensive Philosophy of Humor, and The Philosophy of Laughter and Humor. Peter McGraw also joins us. Peter McGraw is a professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He directs the Humor Research Lab and co-directs the Moral Research Lab. He's the author of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you. John Morrill, I'd like to start with you for a historic context. You've traced the origin of humor historically. You've looked at it even in animals. What does history tell us about humor?
Well, the current best theory, I think, of the evolution of humor is that it evolved from a rough-and-tumble kind of play in apes. Gorillas and chimpanzees, from whom we split in evolution about 6 million years ago, have a kind of laughter that's kind of hard to pick up because it's on the intake rather than the outtake. So instead of laughing ha-ha-ha, they laugh ah-ah-ah. It's kind of like panting. And what it accompanies is mock wrestling, chasing and biting, the kind of things that you do with a little kid. And just as with a little child, when chimps and gorillas chase each other and wrestle each other to the ground and pretend that they're aggressive, they give a signal that they're only playing, and that signal is laughter. So for me, the best theory of the evolution of laughter and humor is that they came from a kind of rough-and-tumble play where it was necessary that they signal to the other person, look, I'm not out to hurt you. I'm not out to break your skin when I pretend to bite you, for example. And that laughter was this play signal. You can see this today when somebody tries to be funny, but they don't give any indication that you're trying to be funny. Well, what that usually ends up in is being threatening. The great example of that was Andy Kaufman, who for years after he left Saturday Night Live went around the country challenging women to wrestle him and defeat him, but he didn't put it in any kind of play frame. He didn't give any comedic hints that he was only playing. So he would show up these wrestling places, and he'd have women who really took him seriously and really wanted to hurt him. So when we are playing and when we want to engage in humor, we need laughter to signal that we're only playing.
Peter McGraw.
So what John says is, I think, is absolutely right, that the origin of humor started with play, but as humans developed and started to have other sorts of rules, new linguistic rules and cultural rules and societal rules, the things that became threatening or that could become wrong started to expand. And so the things that we find funny now have moved beyond the physical. Now it can be toilet humor, things like puns, moving outside of that, satire, irony, sarcasm, and so on. And the work that we've been doing in the Humor Research Lab has identified an explanation for that, something that we call benign violations, that we tend to laugh at, we are delighted by, amused by situations that seem both wrong and okay, in the same way that rough and tumble play is playful and fun when it's both a violation, there's some threat, and then also some idea of, oh, this is okay, this is safe, this is playful. And so this evolution has moved up and branched out and has created what is really a complex yet exciting topic of research.
Amber Day, in your introduction, you look at various kinds of satire. And one of the things that you noted in your, I think it was in the literature review, was that it used to be really the art of the aristocrats, but now it's like a tool for the populist.
Yes, that's how it sort of grossly gets characterized. I don't know that that's entirely true across the board. I think there was, for a long time, literary scholars considered it a conservative art form because it was used in that way. I think there's certainly examples that go against that grain. But there's definitely, you know, there's power in humor, and I think it can be used in either direction. So you can use it certainly to sort of put people in their place and remind them of the status quo and that they're stepping outside of it and using it for ridicule, and that tends to be from top down. But you can certainly also use it to question and to deconstruct the official line and, you know, to point out ironies, and that tends to be more of a sort of subversive bottom up.
Ironies, absurdities, but then, yes, you know, the idea of laughing at rather than laughing with.
Right. Which is certainly different than the sort of evolutionary start of it, in a way.
What's interesting, too, here when we talk about laughing at versus laughing with, I think it was Peter McGraw. I think you were the one who wrote the piece on partisanship and humor. First of all, it sounded like the left won the humor quotient, hands down, but they have different preferences for humor. Conservatives like one kind of humor and liberals like another. Can you break that down for us?
Certainly, the intuition is that the liberals win with regard to the being the funny, you know, the Democrats are the funny party. But I think to Amber's point, a lot of that is the sort of laughing at, the attacking the traditions and attacking those people in power. But when it comes to being funny, more generally, liberals and conservatives seem to be more equal. It's not clear that there's good evidence that liberals are funnier people. And some work done by Dan Ariely reveals that in some ways, depending on the topic, conservatives really have a much better time. I think that follows what we tend to find, this idea that benign violations is subjective. It depends on your values and your beliefs and your experiences. So what's funny to one person is not funny to another. And as a result, in some sense, everybody's funny. Everybody has equal opportunity to be funny, whether or not they're a liberal or a conservative.
And then, of course, there's just the infectiousness of Joe Biden laughing the entire time during his vice presidential debate with Paul Ryan.
Indeed. Yeah, and that's certainly a case where he was using laughter as ridicule.
So in this case, you think he was laughing at Paul Ryan?
Well, I think that he was using laughter to point out the ridiculousness, the absurdities of the things that Ryan was saying, and in a way that was designed to kind of resonate with his party.
John Morell, let's bring you back in here. Now, you've looked at this philosophically, and you say that we really value comic characters more than other types of heroes, like the tragic hero. First of all, tell us why that is, and then walk us through the Barack Obama kind of comic role.
Sure. One of the things that I've studied is the contrast between the heroic tradition, which lasted in American politics well into the 20th century. People like, well, take a turn-of-the-century president like William Howard Taft or even the early Teddy Roosevelt. These people were frequently military veterans, or Eisenhower would be an even better example. These are people who were often military veterans, and they were part of a long tradition that goes back to the ancient Greeks, where the leader is somebody who tries to maximize power. They try to maximize their own knowledge. They try to be on top of everything. And they typically don't laugh very much at themselves. There's a newer style of leadership, which has grown up in the U.S. and throughout the world in the last 30 years or so, which I call post-heroic. And in this style of leadership, you don't emphasize the difference between you and the people you govern. In corporations, for example, in the last 30 years, they've leveled the pyramid. That is, that they've cut out a lot of the levels of organization. And so you see CEOs talking to ordinary people on the manufacturing line. The newer style of leadership tends to have a lot more humor in it. When I do talks like this for political groups and business groups, I often use William Howard Taft, who was not only a very kind of a stuffy president, but he was also our nation's fattest president. On the day of his inauguration, he weighed something over 300 pounds, and there was a new bathtub in the White House, and he got stuck in the tub, and it took four guys over 2 hours to extricate him from the tub. But he swore everybody to secrecy because he wouldn't want the population of the U.S. laughing at him. If you contrast that with somebody like Barack Obama, Obama isn't the funniest guy in the world, but he can certainly poke fun at himself. One of my favorite examples was between the time he was elected and his inauguration. He was in a press conference, and they were throwing him all kinds of tough questions about the economy, which was in a shambles, and all kinds of stuff. And finally, somebody threw him a softball question, and they said, "We hear that you're going to get a dog for the White House for your daughters. What kind of dog are you going to get?" And Obama said, "Well, at first we thought we wanted to get a mutt." And then he said, "Like me." And to me, that was just a watershed moment for a president to say a mutt and then like me, because he's half black, he's half white. It showed a guy who could poke fun at himself. And that kind of leadership is found not just in politics, but also in business. If you look at CEOs today, for example, versus, say, 50 years ago, they've removed the tie. A lot of them have also removed the sport jacket or the suit jacket. And the hero of this movement is Herb Kelleher of Southwest Airlines, who's built a very successful corporation, largely on his playfulness, his sense of humor, and his ability to link both of those to spirit of camaraderie and equality. Humor tends to level differences between people. So when a president or a CEO or your boss can engage in really open humor, I'm not talking about sarcasm or put down, but really open humor, everybody can relax and social relations go a lot better.
Amber Day, this is a perfect place to bring you in because you've looked at this as a form of dissent also, and you've studied all kinds of political dissent, whether it was satire or some other kinds of activism. How do you see this now shaping the political landscape with the new satirists in town?
Sure. Well, I found that last point really interesting, and I kind of want to jump off of it because I feel like it's not just in leadership, but it's become more of a cultural norm to sort of to use a kind of self-deprecating or self-referential irony. And that in many circles, that somehow kind of signals an honesty or a trustworthiness. And I think that's partially because of the way in which political discourse, in particular the sort of public debate, is so kind of stage managed, so perfect, so you know, shiny and fake in many ways, right? We all know the way it's staged, and yet there's this frustration in the way in which the press isn't doing the best job of getting through that, you know, getting past the talking points that have been pre-scripted and all of that. And so I think where a lot of the sort of interesting political satire is coming out these days and the hunger for it is this desire to see somebody actually kind of poke holes in that spectacle and do so in a way in which they're not necessarily an expert, but they're also kind of drawing attention to who they are and that they don't claim to be perfect and that they don't necessarily have all the answers. So there's a sort of humble irony employed there.
And you've noted that this has actually transformed at least some of our comics, our comedians, into really legitimate pundits, or at least semi-legitimate pundits.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, a figure like, you know, Jon Stewart, of course, is the first one to come to mind, is quite different than what's come before. A few decades ago, Chevy Chase was everybody really liked his impression of the presidents and they liked his Weekend Update shtick, but you would never ask Chevy Chase seriously for his take on contemporary politics, right? It just wasn't, nobody would think of doing so. But Jon Stewart is doing something quite different than what Chevy Chase was doing.
Right, and Jon Stewart happens to be quite learned and well-read and brilliant at the same time, which perhaps is what makes a great comic.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, you can be funny in many different ways, but the way in which he's funny and the things that resonate are because he is really sort of revealing things. You know, he tends to sort of, he's very good in particular at revealing the way in which, pulling back the curtain on some of that political debate and some of the staged nature of political discourse, and really kind of watching how it, letting us watch how it's put together in a way that's incredibly satisfying, I think.
Peter McGraw, that sort of touches on something that was in one of your blogs, which deals with the humor being sort of counter-establishment by its nature. And how do you see that fitting in with today's politics?
You know, one of the roots of sort of stand-up comedy, comedy is entertainment, comes out of the motif of the trickster, of the court jester. And on my Humor Code travels, my co-author Joel Werner and I met with Patch Adams, and I can't repeat the language that Patch used, but he basically said that the court jester is the only person who can call the king a jack, you know. And so he actually used more flavorful language than that. And that tradition continues today, where comedians, stand-up or otherwise, are taking aim at the things that are wrong with the traditions, with the people in power, with government, with media. And the Jon Stewarts of the world, they happen to be doing it, you know, better than anyone else, in part because Jon Stewart is really adept. He's quick on his feet. He's a quick thinker. He also has a writer's room full of very funny Harvard graduates who are helping him out along the way. And the very best comedians that we found on the road are ones that can take aim at themselves, as John and Amber mentioned, in part to increase that level of credibility. That if they can make fun of themselves, then they certainly can make fun of all these other things that are wrong in the world.
John Morell, let's bring you back in then. You've talked about the benefits of humor. It helps us individually. You've talked about various ways it helps organizations. How do you think it's beneficial for politics of the world?
It's interesting that the beginning of comedy was in the 5th century BCE in Athens, Greece, and the beginning of democracy was in the 5th century Athens, Greece, 5th century BCE. I think that there's a very strong link between people being able to joke about their leaders, to poke fun at their shortcomings, their hypocrisy, their screw-ups, etc., and their political freedom. So I think that there's a strong link between open societies and democratic values and this ability to have people like Jon Stewart around. If you look at countries that are repressive, if you look, for example, at several countries in the Middle East where joking about the leader can get you executed, you see the opposite of this. And in the West, probably the strongest example of somebody who repressed humor was Hitler. When Hitler was rising to power in the late 20s and early 30s, the first people who criticized him were stand-up comedians. At that time, they were called cabaret comics. And when Hitler came to power in 1933, one of the first things that he did was establish special courts for prosecuting people who made fun of his Third Reich or made fun of the brown shirts or made fun of the way the Nazis were told to march, etc. And over 100 people were executed. One stand-up comic in Berlin, for example, was hanged for naming his horse Adolf. If you look at the Soviet Union, there was a similar pattern. The Soviet Union wanted to control humor and suppress humor that was critical of the leader. And they even set up a special journal, which came out every 10 days in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. It had a larger circulation than Time magazine and Newsweek magazine put together in this country. And it was called Crocodile. And what they allowed humor about was inefficiency, bureaucratic red tape, people being drunk on the job, people not doing their work. But what they didn't allow was jokes about the leadership. So the secretary of the Communist Party was never a legitimate target. So governments have known since the days of ancient Egypt, when the first court jesters were in place, that humor is powerful. And humor may be playful, but it can be playfully critical. And so governments that are more open allow for more humor. Governments that are more controlled and repressive are afraid of humor.
Amber Day, I don't recall if you actually had this in your literature or in your book, but can you tell us what kind of a measurable impact some of these new, what you called Renaissance comics, are making in society in America today or in the other countries that you looked at?
The short answer is no, but I think, yes, the problem is sort of how do you measure that effect, and that's the hardest thing to do, right? And I think we tend to sort of look at it very simplistically and say, well, is this one piece going to have a measurable effect on the next election? And the answer is usually no, of course it isn't. But I think these comics and, you know, a number of the filmmakers, the activists that I'm looking at are making a difference and they are doing something. But I think it's smaller. I think it's shifting the conversation in small ways, changing the terms in which we talk about particular issues, slowly, or even actually pushing issues that were very peripheral and only sort of talked about in marginal counterpublics, pushing those further into the wider public sphere and into the wider discussion. And I think that's huge, and that's the kind of thing, these shifts have to happen before change ever takes place, right? Because sort of public perception has to change, but it is the stuff that's incredibly hard to actually track and measure.
We do know from the Pew studies that The Daily Show was certainly the leading source of news, political news for young people, particularly through the election periods.
Right.
Perhaps we should take a little shift and talk about, well, what makes things funny? And this is something that you've all looked at as well. Peter McGraw, that's kind of the whole subject of your institute. Why don't you start us with this? Why are some things funny and some things not?
So I recognize that some of my theorizing isn't always popular as a kind of outsider moving into this field. My expertise is in judgment and decision-making and the study of emotion more generally. And when I stumbled on this question, I surveyed the research, including John's work, and found hints at different perspectives, one that's different than the traditional view of humor arising from some form of incongruity, that there's some mismatch between what we expect and what we get in the world. As I mentioned earlier, I, based on my reading, came to the conclusion that actually humor has a counterintuitive underpinning, that of something negative, what we call a violation. And luckily, there's support for this by people a lot smarter than me. Mark Twain has a great quote where he says that the secret source of humor is not joy, it's sorrow. There is no humor in heaven. That is because because heaven's perfect, there's nothing actually to laugh at. And the studies that we've been doing in the humor research lab seems to help support that idea. But of course, the things that are violations don't normally amuse us. They upset us. And so you have to have this other judgment, this recognition that the situation is safe or acceptable or okay, or as we say, benign.
So then it really could collapse into the tragic.
So the tragic is actually a really good source of humor in many ways, but it also keeps with a saying that's at least been attributed to Mark Twain, that the humor is tragedy plus time, that as time passes, as you get some distance from the thing that's bad, it helps transform it from a violation into a benign violation.
And John Morrell, would you agree?
Yes. Peter's notion of a benign violation fits fairly well with the traditional theory called the incongruity theory, which says that in a humorous situation, something violates your expectations. You expect A and you get not A, or even better, you get the opposite of A. So your expectations are violated. That's part one. And part two is you don't go into a negative emotion. You don't get scared. You don't become sad or depressed. You're not disgusted or angry. Instead, you are able to enjoy the incongruity. You're able to enjoy this surprise. Humans are the only ones who can pull this off. You can surprise your cat, for example, by moving her food dish to a different spot in the kitchen. You can dress up in a funny Halloween costume in front of your dog, but you'll never get a laugh out of either one of them. So humans are the only ones who can experience something that they weren't ready for, even the opposite of what they were ready for, and even including their own disappointments and their own mistakes, and somehow enjoy it. They can have their mental train derailed and enjoy the train wreck. So Peter's notion of a violation, which is safe or okay or benign, I think it works very well. And you notice that in some situations, the same event which surprises, say, a room full of people will make some of them angry and others of them amused. So I think there's a personal difference between people who go into a negative emotion versus people who go into laughter instead. And that's basically what Peter referred to quickly as distance. I call it mental distance. People who can laugh about things typically see it from a higher perspective. They step back. They're less emotionally engaged. People who tend to experience everything with anger or fear or sadness or depression tend to be emotionally wrapped up in things. And that's the heart of tragedy. The difference between tragedy and comedy isn't the subject matter. In comedy and in tragedy, the subject matter is disappointment and failure and suffering and death and our inability to understand what's happening to us. Comedy isn't about happy, successful people doing well. It's about the same thing tragedy is about. But the tragic character goes into her emotions. She gets swept away by them. The comic character steps back and thinks her way rather than feels her way through her problems.
Amber Day.
Yeah, and I would just add to that a little bit that I don't think we should see comedy, humor, irony as completely removed from the serious or the feeling or, you know, feeling very strongly about something. Because there tends to be this assumption that, you know, somebody like Jon Stewart, well, it's bad for politics, right? It's cynical. And you know, we're just laughing at it. We're not really caring about it. And I spend a lot of time sort of pushing against that assumption because I think what's really interesting about a lot of the political humor in particular that we see right now is a lot of it is actually very earnest, you know, and it's being used to rile us up to some degree, particularly in some of the activist groups that I take a look at, or some of the viral videos that we see circulating before an election, that they tend to use irony and humor and satire to get our attention and to grab us. But and I think there is that aspect of the benign violation because the satisfaction comes in knowing, wow, somebody else notices this, right? Somebody else is seeing this, and that makes me feel a little bit better. But I think the intended effect, a lot of the time, if it is being used to garner attention or to actively get people involved in something, is to get them to feel like to get them mad, really, or to get them upset about it, and feel like there are other people who are laughing at the same thing and who are upset about the same thing, and that there's sort of that strength in numbers.
Thank you, all three of you, for joining us. John Morrell, Amber Day, Peter McGraw. It's great to have you here with us on the Scholar Circle. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Amber Day is a professor of performance studies in the English and Cultural Studies Department at Bryant University. She's the author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate, and Breaking Boundaries in Politics and Political Entertainment Studies. John Morrell is professor of philosophy and department chair of religious studies at William & Mary College. He is the founder of International Society for Humor Studies and the author of Comic Relief, A Comprehensive Philosophy of Humor, and The Philosophy of Laughter and Humor. Peter McGraw is a professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He directs the Humor Research Lab and co-directs the Moral Research Lab. He's the author of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. Stay tuned.
Me personally, I think healthcare should be free for all Americans. That's just my opinion. Yeah. But you guys who didn't clap, that means you can't relate. Let me tell you something. It's messed up when you're too broke to go to the doctors. You know you should be at the doctors, but instead you in CVS at 2 o'clock in the morning trying to diagnose yourself. You be walking in like, oh, shit. My kidneys are messed up. I better get me some NyQuil. Can't hurt NyQuil is good for bad kidneys. I'm gonna get some Tums for this tumor I got, too. You know, Tums is in the word tumors.
That was award-winning comic actor Reuben Paul, who joins us live in studio with two of his colleagues, award-winning humorist, writer, storyteller Dylan Brody, and writer, producer, and comedian Steve Scroven. Reuben Paul has appeared on CBS's The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, Comics Unleashed on ABC, and HBO Comedy Showcase. Dylan Brody has appeared on A&E's Comedy on the Road and Fox TV's Comedy Express. He's written for Jay Leno's Tonight Show, recorded 3 CDs, and written 2 novels and a play. Steve Scroven started out as a stand-up comic and a host of MTV show Mouth to Mouth, and went on to write television and movies, including the CBS sitcom Everybody Loves Raymond. Welcome to the Scholar's Circle, our annual meeting of the comics. It's really in honor of Stand Up for Main Street. Steve Scroven is with us here.
Public Citizen Stand Up for Main Street, which is this coming Sunday, October 6th, at 6:30 at the WGA Theater. And we've got a great lineup of comics, 2 of them which are here today. Reuben Paul, Dylan Brody, Mark Maron, Betsy Salkin, Greg Fitzsimmons, Alan Havey, and Carol Leifer, along with KPFK's own Jimmy Dore and David Feldman, co-hosting.
Oh, Jimmy.
We've got Dylan Brody here in studio with us, who I understand has a particular affinity for scholars.
I come from a family of academicians and scholars. I moved to Los Angeles to get away from my father, who was for 10 years the associate provost for the arts at MIT, or as most people pronounce it, arts at MIT. He was hired for the job when somebody happened to be in England to see his Cambridge University production of The Pirates of Penzance, starring Professor Stephen Hawking as the Pirate King. And the singing wasn't great, but the choreography was innovative. I do that joke all over the country. People get very nervous. But Professor Hawking himself has heard me do that joke and tells me I'm a very funny man. Although, in fairness, it's impossible to tell when he's being sarcastic. My father, last year I got to go east and see his magnificent Heisenberg Uncertainty opera at MIT. A magnificent musicale during which it's possible to accurately determine either the position or the momentum of the fat lady at any given time. These are not jokes. This is what you were saying. I have an affinity for scholars. My entire act apparently is only for the PhD crowd when you come down to it. And if I do in fact hear you using quintessential and penultimate interchangeably, then I will judge you harshly. So I have the right act for this kind of a show, I think.
Well, what excuse do you have then, Reuben Paul, for being here on the Scholar Circle?
I have to Google everything he just said so I can understand.
My act comes with footnotes.
Well, I came from the complete opposite type of family, not academic at all. I'm just happy to be a part of anything that stands up to corruption.
To Wall Street, to K Street.
To Wall Street, to everything. I'm more social, political, but more social, and it's great to have a platform to say the things that I like to say on stage.
You guys were sitting in on the scholars panel, the different politics and politicians. And you and I were talking ahead of time. We didn't have the rest of the panel here. I've just been thinking about what's going on in the news and such and all of the various characters that we have. And I was just wondering, can we take these politicians seriously?
I don't think it's healthy to take anyone in politics too seriously at this point. I mean, when you have things like Ted Cruz doing what is ostensibly political theater that then degenerates over the course of 21 hours into political vaudeville and then kind of a political minstrel show. There was a point there where I really expected Mike Lee, to be addressing him as Mr. Interlocutor. It was not a pretty picture.
I don't really take politicians seriously. I think you take the issue seriously because they're serious issues. But I can give you one perspective just coming from the black community. When Obama got elected president, there was this thing like it was Martin Luther King that we just, elected as president. And at the end of the day, he's a politician just like everybody else. Just because he's black, the first one doesn't mean he's not a politician.
Right.
So I think you have to look at the issues, but I don't give any passes either way. A politician is a politician at the end of the day to me.
The big difference between politicians and comics, as far as I'm concerned, is comics, we get to tell the truth.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
And what about the difference between comics and academics?
Oh, well, nothing makes for funnier material than the hermeneutic dissection of a joke. I think no joke is really complete until the audience has had it fully diagrammed and parsed on a whiteboard.
It's interesting.
God, I hope so.
One of the philosophers said something earlier that I thought was interesting about earlier how comics used to be scholars. When I first started doing comedy, I remember having a conversation with Franklin Ajay. And one thing that he told me was when he started doing comedy, the reason why he wanted to do comedy was because all the smarter people were the ones who did comedy. Like, it was a very,
right,
you know, cool thing to be a part of, because the well-educated were the ones that were doing comedy, and that's what attracted him to the art form.
Ultimately, to do comedy, you have to be the smartest person in the room. It is the skill of taking a room full of people by surprise with the same trick every 15 or 20 seconds.
Absolutely.
For an hour.
Yep.
And in order to do that, you got to be always at least one step ahead of them.
Absolutely. I agree.
One of the things that I related to that they did say was about power. And I've told my kids this. It's the most powerful thing in the world to me. It's the only reason anybody's ever listened to me say anything.
The only reason I listen to you.
Yeah. Well, on the off chance that you might chuckle.
I talk about it in my new novel, Laughs Last, available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble online.
Wait. We're plugging Public Citizen Stand Up for Main Street October 6th.
I wasn't plugging. I was starting a sentence. So if you'll allow me to finish.
Public Citizen Stand Up for Main Street, where Dylan would be performing at and probably hawking his book.
Do you think I could put Kill the Messenger there?
Yeah, that's a real laugh riot, Kill the Messenger. That's Maria's book about genocide.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, yeah.
It's a great read.
It's great. Listen, that's not a benign violation.
My first book was the Modern Depression Guidebook. I think you can find laughter in anything.
Okay.
But in my new book, Laughs Last, available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble online, I talk about humor as a superpower. It allows you to change the way people think about something forever.
Yeah.
In a way that nothing else. The Druids, if I may go scholarly on you for a minute, had something called the satire, which I believe was the origin of what we now call the limerick.
Yeah.
Whereby they could take any ruler or tribal leader of whose behavior they disapproved, write a 2 or 4 line rhyming poem about them that ridiculed them, and immediately take away their power. It was considered one of their great magics.
Wow. Yeah.
Because nobody can continue to take someone seriously once they have been thoroughly and properly ridiculed. The FBI tried to get David Steinberg to stop doing his joke about Nixon at Nixon's behest. He had a joke where he would say, "I will say one thing and you will never be able to look at Nixon the same way again. His face looks like a foot."
Yeah.
And the FBI showed up at his green room before a show and said, "Oh, there's been a warning that you could be assassinated if there's any Nixon-related face-foot material in your act tonight," which he immediately saw as a pointless ruse.
Wow.
And went ahead and did the joke. The powerful and self-important are terrified of comedy.
Yes. And the scholars were talking about the 5000 BCE in Athens, and that's actually when Dylan started.
It's true. I started.
He worked that room.
Yeah. Well, first I worked the library.
Yeah.
And then we made my way up to.
Everybody was like, "Shh."
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Socrates handed him some hemlock after his act.
You don't know from heckling until they put you in with the lions. That was a whole different group of people. That was the Romans with their lions.
Earlier when we were talking about who do you take seriously, and you know, you were really belittling Senator Cruz.
Yes.
And I was just thinking, you know, I think you're just envious that he could do stand-up for that much longer than you.
You know, there's a difference between doing stand-up and standing up.
Yes. Just standing up for 21 hours is not the same.
And he did Dr. Seuss.
And he didn't understand Dr. Seuss.
That's
he didn't understand that it was about trying something, not trying something. He completely misunderstood green eggs and freaking ham.
Green eggs and freaking ham, by the way, is a whole different book.
Well,
green,
you know, if you've ever had your freaking ham freaked, it's a wonderful...
I think we all know how painful that can be.
Yes, it's a marinade.
Can we go back to the scholars and the whole power thing that I found interesting? Not power in terms of the power the comedian has, but I just think of what people laugh at and don't laugh at. One thing that you always see in comedy is, you know, the victim is always the funniest perspective,
right,
to have comedically. No one whose life is great and who has everything together is usually not funny. People want to come and relate and connect with someone that they feel go through the same things that they go through, or point out the absurdity of things that they see or might not have seen, you know, that they can all relate to. Nobody, you know, the most powerful, well-off
guy
in the room.
But you look so together.
Ah, please.
Come on.
I love his jacket.
Maria's lost complete control of the show.
And her bladder, apparently.
Oh, my God.
Did we mention Public Citizen Stand Up for Main Street, Sunday, October 6th, WGA Theater in Beverly Hills?
I am so excited to be a part of this show. This thing that Stephen puts together, it is an opportunity not only to really change the world for the better, but also to get stage time. And to my mind, that's just a win-win, which is also the name of my imaginary panda. But he spells it N-G-U-Y-E-N, N-G-U-Y-E-N, because his father is Vietnamese.
Oh, my gosh.
Tell us a little bit about what Stand Up for Main Street does, please.
Well, Stand Up for Main Street is a benefit for Public Citizen, the legendary advocacy group that was started by Ralph Nader in 1971. He hasn't actually been associated with it for the last 30 years. Robert Weissman is the president now. And it's the reason we have airbags in cars. We have the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Freedom of Information Act. They do all that wonky inside Washington baseball stuff that we don't have time for. And the reason we do these benefits is that they can take no corporate money. It's supported by people, real people. And so Public Citizen is the lobbyist for the people.
Awesome. You know what I'm most fascinated about Steve Scroven?
Oh, boy.
What? He moved from being a speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush to Stand Up for Main Street.
Wow.
I was not a speechwriter for George H.W. My college friend.
Saw the truth.
A friend of mine.
Has no one taught you yes and?
No, my friend was a speechwriter for him, a college friend of mine, and he asked me to, when he was first elected in 88, he had a bunch of speechwriters who were like Bob Hope guys, and my friend thought some youth, you know, I was youthful then. And so he gave me a bunch of stuff that the communications department had brainstormed on, and I turned some of it into jokes, and he actually ended up doing some of my jokes during the course of a couple of years.
Oh, wow.
And it was all for nonpartisan kind of things, because I didn't even vote for the guy. I voted for Dukakis. That's how great I was.
Do you have a button that says you voted for Dukakis anywhere?
But so I would do that for, they're all for the correspondence dinner, alfalfa club dinners, all these nonpartisan things. Mm-hmm. And the last time I did it was like in the middle of his term. And I would always write the speech, I would always write the jokes as if he was going to do my whole speech, which of course he just may take one thing out of it because he had a lot of input coming from different places. And the last time I did it, I got a little in over my head and I wrote this a summary paragraph and I got very into, I was talking about dissent and how underneath every joke is an element of dissent. And it was this very serious thought, earnest thought about, you know, the value of undeniable value of thoughtful dissent or something. And I had a bunch of other metaphors and things in there. And I faxed it in the days when you fax things. This was like 1990 or something to Washington, to the speechwriter. And I immediately called him. I said, you know what? Forget that last paragraph. I got in over my head. Just crumple it up, throw it. And he goes, no, I want to work with that. I said, yeah, right. So about 9 months later, it's January, I think, of 91 or 92 maybe by this, 91, I think, in the Desert Storm has taken place the week before, and the State of the Union address has actually been put off for a week, and I'm in my kitchen in Glendale, and I've got like a boom box on the refrigerator as I'm doing the dishes, and I don't have a dishwasher. I'm doing the dishes, and I'm listening to the State of the Union address. And in the midst of this long State of the Union address, he gives one paragraph to the protest movement that occurred at that time when we were at the first Gulf War. And I hear this phrase, the undeniable value of thoughtful dissent. And I kind of perk up and I go, wow, that sounds familiar. You know, and so the next day I looked in the paper at the transcript and there was that phrase. And then I looked in my notes from that in my files and there it was in the midst of that paragraph. They had pulled that phrase out, and then the next week, an article came in the New Republic, and in the first paragraph, they quoted that phrase, the undeniable value of thoughtful dissent. So here I was trying to write jokes for the president, and he didn't use the joke. He used
the phrase.
A phrase in the State of the Union address, which—
That you didn't get a dime for.
Not get a dime for, but that didn't bother me as much as the president— is quoting a guy who doesn't even have a dishwasher in Glendale. What is, well, these are the resources he's calling upon.
Wow, that's impressive.
Reuben Paul.
I'm the son of immigrants from Haiti that came to America in the late 60s. And
Maria doesn't like this story as it is. You wrote for an immigrant from Haiti for several years. Sorry, go ahead.
And stand-up comedy was probably the last thing I thought I would ever do. And early on in my career, I was fortunate enough to work with, you know, some great acts. You know, I just love the art form, and to be a part of a show like this, it's an honor because there's a lot of great comics and with opinions. And I think that's great when comedians have a point of view and have something to say, and it can be used to enlighten and educate and make people think.
Is it dissent? Is comedy dissent for you?
Yeah, I agree with Steve. I think there's
a huge part of comedy that comes from that. There's so much power in comedy where you can attack the status quo and go against the things that you believe people should be paying attention to. And one thing that's been great for me for the last year and a half, I've literally traveled all over the world, from South Africa to Australia, New Zealand, Jakarta, the Middle East, and doing shows in all these places, and the mainland China. And it's interesting to see people's perspective on the U.S. Mm-hmm. that live in other places. It's very enlightening when you travel the world and you're doing comedy. Something I wanted to address, one of the scholars said something regarding, I think it was censorship and the freedom to say what you want to say. That's not necessarily true. I mean, I've done tons of military shows for the U.S. military, and you show up and they'll give you a list of things that you should not talk about. So,
like what?
Homosexuality, don't make jokes about the president. There's a lot of things that you're not allowed to say. So it's not like, hey, land of the free, say whatever you want to say. They're like, hey, you know, it's not written down, but, you know, it's you go into a room and they debrief you on what you on subjects you should probably stay away from.
And do you usually include any of that in your shtick?
Because you can't tell a comic what to do. yeah, I think a lot of times my humor comes from a social place that may, you know, of course it leads into political things, but it's not directed towards any specific politician or the president. It's more the white man. So,
so specifically, it would not be the hard president. To make it about the president if you want the white man.
Exactly, because I mean, he's the president, but still he knows in control.
Yeah.
What about the white woman?
White women are great.
That was Reuben Paul, ladies and gentlemen. Reuben Paul.
No, but I just think, you know, when you look symbolically, you know, the whole notion of, you know, especially back in the 60s, I guess, when everything used to be, oh, the white man, the man trying to hold you down. It was just symbolic of the government. And whether Barack is black or biracial or mutt or whatever it is, still government is still perceived as the man.
Well, thank you all so much for being with us here on the comics version of the Scholar's Circle. Steve Scroven, Dylan Brody, and Reuben Paul.
Maria Armudian, is that right? Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. Thank you for downgrading the show from scholars to us. We really appreciate that.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @Armudian.